If your passion lies in elite British road racing and you want the inside line on the teams, riders, organisers and sponsors that make this sport such a compelling spectacle, you're in the right place. I'm Timothy John, and joining me for every episode is my co-host, the Managing Director of Brother UK, Phil Jones.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here. We're going to use this platform to talk about all the key issues surrounding the sport. With special guests, deep dives into hot topics and plenty of chat, we'll keep you informed about all things UK racing. Stay tuned.
Coming up in this analysis of our two-part investigation into elite British road racing, we discuss the value of television coverage to the sponsors of cycling teams in the new digital landscape.
Media consumption has totally changed. Television isn't always the answer. I get it in terms of what BC are saying. It's frankly not worth the money. If I was responsible for that money, I would probably make a similar decision. So the second part to that question is, well, okay, well, if we're not spending it there, where will we spend it? What I haven't seen or heard yet is actually, well, the chunk of money that we were investing there is now going to be invested over here instead. And I think this is probably why the teams were initially quite shocked by that announcement.
We consider the value of the domestic road scene in developing riders in a sport where the race for talent has accelerated dramatically.
The British sport, the NRS, is more of a career in its own right than those riders who want to stay here. Those riders who are capable of riding in Europe at World Tour level, like Harry, like Matt Holmes, they have the talent and they need to take a different pathway. The whole scene, the whole thing is changing. Riders are being discovered at a younger age.
And we discuss ways in which the National Road Series might gain a higher international profile, befitting the quality of its races and the talent of its riders. European teams, the heavyweights of the world, so they must know by now that this country does not lack talent. We've also got fantastic races in the shape of the Lincoln Grand Prix, in the shape of the Cycle Classic, in the shape of the Tour of the Reservoir. I mean, why isn't this scene more highly regarded than it is? Hello and welcome to this new episode of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast with me, Timothy John. Today I'm joined by my co-host Phil Jones, the Managing Director of Brother UK, and by Larry Hickmott, the founder and editor of VeloUK.net, to talk through some of the issues raised in our two-part investigation of elite British road racing, The Way Ahead. Now, if you haven't had a chance to listen yet, then do please check out Episode 6, Parts 1 and 2, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, any of the leading podcast platforms. Our list of expert witnesses, it's fair to say, is pretty impressive, ranging from Brother Cycling graduates to the World Tour like Harry Tanfield and Sophie Wright, to commercial experts like Jonathan Durling, the Partnerships Director at Sweet Spot Group, organisers of the Tour of Britain, the Women's Tour and the Tour Series. Today we'll make a further analysis of some of the key topics covered in both parts and several others that we couldn't fit in, including plans from elite road racing manager Eric Rousel for a tiered structure and elite development teams. Phil, let's begin with a pretty fundamental question. What is the difference, from a sponsor's perspective at least, between the value of racing and the social media bubble teams have had to rely on to generate a return on investment in these times of pandemic?
Well, the reality is, I mean, domestic racing sort of in the sort of National Road Series sort of level doesn't really attract huge audiences in reality, Tim. When I've been to a lot of them myself, and when you look at the physical number of spectators by the side of the road, then you probably might look at that, and it depending on which race you go to, of course, I go to the Lincoln GP, where almost the whole city comes out, absolutely fantastic. You can go to other races where you might get half a dozen villagers stood by the side of the road understanding what's going on. So I don't think necessarily the audience is what it's all about, but actually the content that comes from the race is actually the key thing. So when people like Larry report on it, start posting images, you get other photographers that are attending. So it sort of generates its own social media, it generates its own volume, it generates its own reach through virtue of the fact that the race is there. So I think it's a combination of these things, really. And you have to look at it in the whole as a sponsor. You can't look at it just as one thing. You have to say, well, actually, you know, what do we want from placing a sponsorship investment in this particular sport? And, you know, for someone like Brother, We've discussed many times over the years that ultimately what we're looking to do is take many of the characteristics of what the sport represents, you know, technology, performance, teamwork, ambition, and all of these things, and sort of use those as sort of general communication pillars in some of our wider communication, where our technology also uses that same messaging. So we use the sport really as a metaphor for many of the things that we represent as a business.
Another big revelation that came out of our investigative podcast was Eric's vision for a tiered approach. This is a longer term vision. He makes it clear, doesn't he? It's not going to happen overnight, but ultimately he thinks this is where the National Road Series should head. And let's hear a bit now from Eric on precisely that ambition.
I think the future we need to look at is a more tiered approach to this, where there's potentially three different series. There could be a top one, something in the middle, and then potentially much more of a development series that sits below it. That could then provide more certainty to teams that we think, right, we know what we're competing in, we're aiming for that series. If we can win in that, we can potentially have some exposure in the next series, and the continental teams will have that exposure as well, because they can still do the top series, but they could drop down and do the bottom stuff. So it sort of gives a little bit of direction of where the teams almost sit and what would be there for them, rather than at the minute it's sort of one suits everybody, which is not what we've got in the UK. And that's almost the beauty of racing in the UK. We've got completely different circumstances. You've got someone that, you know, might work as a postman that's racing one week, and then you've got a rider which might be paid 40 grand racing the same race the next week. And we've got to try and develop a calendar that suits everybody, which is very, very tricky. But my idea is that we separate things out a little bit and have a bit more of a tiered approach to it, rather than just relying on one thing for everybody.
Pretty ambitious vision there. From Eric, this three-tiered structure. And Larry, how do you sort of read that, really? Are we going to get more appropriate racing, which I think is what Eric wants? At the moment, he makes the point, doesn't he? You've got a rider who's delivering the post 6 days a week, and then on the seventh day finds himself racing against a salaried rider from a UCI Continental team. Equally, you know, the UCI Continental teams, you know, if they're sort of shackled to riding every level of the British calendar, then they don't get the time and opportunity to go and develop their skills overseas at races like the Tour de Normandy. Has Eric got this right? Are we going to get more appropriate racing, or is this another level of complexity for teams that are already kind of stretched to breaking point?
For me, I have no clue as to why Eric's going with this where he's going with it. Because, as you say, it's just introducing another level of complexity. If you took the postman out, someone like Matt Buttrell, who was a postman yes. for years and years and used to ride prems and that sort of thing, if you took all those riders out, how many riders would you be left with in a race? Not very many. There aren't, you know, even in a UCI team.
I think, in fairness, what he's trying to do is make sure the postman isn't racing against the UCI. The UCI riders, rather than replacing them entirely. I mean, are there enough races to go round? Are there enough riders for that level of segmentation?
I don't think there are enough riders. And I think if the UCI system in this country was introduced in a better way, i.e. Introducing minimum wages for UCI Conti teams as they have in France, and also making sure that they also have a continental program, that there wouldn't be that many riders and that many teams. So I think the system as it is fine. Obviously, there's a thing called evolution rather than revolution, and I certainly think there needs to be some evolution and some subtle changes to it. But the bottom line is there just isn't enough national B racing or even national A racing, etc., etc., and the other categories for riders per se. So I would rather BC looked at that problem rather than trying to change something that, to me, already works. Because if you look at a prem where you have 100 to 150 riders, and that, you know, it's made up of a lot of elite teams, but I remember trying to ride and did ride the Havant Grand Prix when that was a premier calendar. And I was just part of a very small team, and I rode it on my own. And I did find out I was way out of my depth, But I came away from that one race with a lot of experience and a lot of learning at just how hard those races are.
Phil, just sort of zooming out to the sort of structural aspect of that. I mean, you run a huge business on a day-to-day basis. What scale of challenge do you think Eric is going to face here in getting people to buy into the idea, doing things a different way, selling the idea internally and externally? I mean, it's no easy task by itself, I wouldn't have thought.
Oh, it's prime for the one of the management buzz phrases, Tim, which is stakeholder management.
Ah, I like it.
Stakeholder management. And we you know, when you've got large international businesses like Brother, where you've got, you know, European headquarters, you've got all the offices in Europe, global headquarters, you've got multiple stakeholders, and you know, BC have a huge number of stakeholders in their overall organisation, whether that be through funding, through, you know, race organisation, you know, internal and external. So when you're trying to make changes, these things never happen quickly. They don't, unfortunately. So it might well be that, you know, radical ideas or new things that you want to get done, they don't normally happen quickly, because there's often lots of governance things that have got to be done. And certainly when you're looking at something like a federation level, there's huge amounts of governance and approvals that change needs to go through. So I think Eric has, you know, doing the right thing, which is, look, coming up with ideas. That's the one thing we do need right now, is actually someone who's A, responsible for the programme. That's great that Eric's now in post doing that. The second thing is that, you know, right, is to consult with those stakeholders and then come back with, you know, ideas and actions which are then probably implementable. And then your job is to then start moving those ideas on. So going through the various approval levels to get everything done. So, you know, kind of back to Larry's point there, really. I can understand the sort of the goal image of that. But to make that happen, I would just say you just need the right volume of participants. So it could potentially work, I guess, if there were a lot more people. But right now, race organisers need a certain volume of people on the line, don't they? Paying the entry fees in order that they've got the income that they need to cover the overheads of putting the race on in the first place. So right now, I can't see that there's the sort of volume, and maybe this is the longer term ambition that Eric's got here, to build that volume in order to make for that tiering system to make sense. But for now, it probably wouldn't be so good to just sort of have a race put on and then ultimately only have a few teams actually participating, because they just end up racing the same people every week.
If I could just come in on that, one of the things that happened this year was there was a lot more club racing, certainly in time trials anyway. And that sort of taught me, coming from a club structure in Australia where most racing is club run rather than opens. And what I would say from that tier structure is, if we look at the 90s and the 80s when they were pro racing and the pros would race, but they would only race with 30 or 40 riders, could racing in this country sustain that? I don't think so, as Phil just pointed out. So I think the two tiers that need to be looked at are, one, club racing. I think that's a very good idea, because I've come from club racing in Australia, and that's what we have week in, week out. And I certainly think, as a way of introducing people to the sport, that would be a brilliant opportunity. But in terms of changing what we already have in the National Road Series, I think it works already in many ways. There may well need to be tweaks that Eric can see as a former rider that I can't see. But I'd be quite happy to look at that when that in the public domain.
Yeah, I think you both make some very interesting points. You know, particularly, you know, Phil, when you say it's good to have some ideas. You know, Matt Hallam makes that point, doesn't he, in the podcast, that after years of stagnation, suddenly, you know, we've got somebody leading some ideas at BC and coming up with new ways to improve the scene. And that in itself is to be welcomed. Whether this tiered strategy is a kind of build it and they will come scenario. I mean, in fairness to Eric, he says it's a long-term ambition. Let's just see how that plays out.
I was just going to add, I mean, also we must remind ourselves that BC have a new incoming chief executive in Brian Facer, who's now been, you know, his appointment's been officially announced, which is great. And what you'll also find when you get a new CEO appointed is sort of the energy in an organisation of any kind changes. So, you know, the leadership, what they want, and obviously Brian's arrival will mean he'll want to come in. He'll look around and he'll start listening to people and starting to think of how the entity can improve and all this kind of good stuff. So with Eric's appointment and perhaps a new CEO too, we might begin to see things move a bit, and that may create a completely different environment within the Federation. Clearly, there's lots of other things that exist in terms of structure, articles of association, the way things get done. But ultimately, with new energy and potentially new ambition, it's surprising what can be achieved.
That would be great to see, wouldn't it? And wouldn't it be great to have Brian on a future episode of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast? Let's watch that space. And another big idea from Eric that we heard in our investigative episodes was this plan for an elite development team status. Now, Eric's goal for that? Well, let's hear from the man himself.
The status of the proposal we're putting in place for elite development teams is for senior teams, so focusing on sort of under 23, under 27 riders, really. It's trying to introduce a rebirth of the old elite national team status, which was brought in, I think, 2014 or 15, and sort of recent years has fizzled out a bit. So it's trying to rebirth that, but obviously doing it for men's and for women's teams this time, rather than just men's teams. So it's very much focused on those teams that sit just below UCI teams. They're still technically registered as clubs with British Cycling. They're not UCI teams. They are more than clubs, they are teams, but there's not actually anything that recognises them as teams. So it's trying to create something for them which gives them sort of a status and a focus and helps sort of build their backing and their credibility as well, as saying, well, these are the teams that are riding all the national series, providing a platform for their riders, getting international race entries. They're not UCI teams, but they are doing all the right things to try and provide the riders with that stepping stone to step on and step up to UCI team. Cycling Sheffield is a fantastic example, and what they did with Connor Swift. He rode for Cycling Sheffield, developed really well as a rider there, moved on to Madison, and then jumped up now to riding the Tour de France this year. That's one complete example there of where that pathway would work, that a rider can go onto one of those elite teams, develop from that to a Conti team. There wasn't necessarily any connections between Cycling Sheffield and Madison Genesis, but Cycling Sheffield certainly gave him that pathway to develop onto that team, which then gave him the pathway to develop up to a Tour de France rider. So that's the sort of the pathway that we see in what we're trying to develop. I think we need to almost get away in the UK of saying, well, let's judge ourselves by how many Conti teams we've got. For me, I'd prefer to have one Conti team in the UK, but that one team do things properly and do things correct and support the riders and provide them with a really good race programme, really good support around them, rather than have eight UCI teams which aren't actually that much different to a club team. And I think that's what we need to get away from, judging it by, well, how many Conti teams have we got? Because if we've got more, then it's brilliant. Actually, we might have less, but they're really well run, really well supported. That's, for me, is more important than just having loads and loads of teams. And I think that's hopefully where sort of the elite teams can come in. If people can see value for riding for an elite team, then that makes them more attractive than everyone saying, well, we've got to be a Conti team. And really, there's not an awful lot of difference other than they get to ride the Tour of Britain, which is obviously a huge thing. But in my opinion, you shouldn't set up a Conti team just to ride the Tour of Britain. You're doing it for very wrong reasons if that's why you're doing it. So hopefully that's where sort of the elite teams will come into its own, that we can build on them and progress that, and that will become more attractive.
So good to hear there from Eric. As we say, the elite development team status is another of his new ideas. And I think what he's trying to do there basically is narrow the gap between club and continental. And he makes the point, doesn't he, that the scene needs fewer and better UCI continental teams. I mean, is that an opinion that you would share, Larry? Do we have too many continental teams? It doesn't seem so long ago that we had six of them, and they all ran really well. Obviously, we're in very different economic circumstances at the moment. Do they serve as a useful aspiration, or is it a step beyond what we can afford and actually what we need at the moment in domestic cycling?
It depends on what we're all trying to achieve here. When I spoke to Giles Pidcock, he mentioned that
in this country, there's only around 20 riders who are probably capable of riding at World Tour. Do you want to change everything? Do you want to have a whole system of changes made just for 20 riders just to make it into World Tour when there are already things in place to help them do that? They just need to be aware of them and to strive to be part of them. Are there too many UCI teams? I'm not sure. That at the moment, it's looking like there's going to be four. There might be five. I don't know. But I do think that there does need to be a few changes, as I've already mentioned, like bringing in a minimum wage, because one of the problems that we find with the UCI teams, as we've seen when Madison Genesis went, and even this year with Canyon, they lost a couple of riders like Alex Patton. I think by having a minimum wage, you can keep these riders in the sport. And I think that is a key thing. To lose so many very talented and experienced riders is a big loss for the sport. So do we have too many teams? I don't know, but I certainly do think there need to be changes. And I think there would be a natural culling process, if you like, if those changes were brought in. UCI teams would only exist if they could match those requirements, i.e. a minimum wage to keep the riders in the sport, and also a continental program to help develop riders.
It's a very admirable aspiration that riders should have a minimum wage. And you know, we haven't had a minimum wage before, but we've had salaried riders, you know, back in this very recent heyday, you know, JLT, UK Youth, NFTO, Enduro Racing, et cetera, et cetera. But it ain't so easy, is it, Phil? Give us a sense of the sort of economic requirements of putting a minimum wage in place.
Yeah, it's really tricky, isn't it? Because the external environment is not great for raising the funds to pay salaries. And, you know, the really, I think the interesting thing is that you can call yourself a professional cycling team without paying people. You see what I mean?
Is that unhelpful?
Well, I guess there's, you know, the image that you perhaps want to send when your vans all turn up in the pits and you get, you know, the fans walking in, and they probably don't really understand the economics, and they don't really need to understand the economics that sit behind it. But I think maybe within that, perhaps if you can prove that you are paying people and everyone is earning a wage out of it, then perhaps only then you could use the word professional in your team title, for example. So that might be one way to think about it. But the reality is the economics of that sit behind the domestic sport now are so fragile in terms of the teams that we do have, even the continental teams. You know, there's certain things that you've got to pay. Of course, you need to pay your deposit to the UCI. Of course, that's refundable, the guarantee. But you still need to be able to raise the cash to be able to pay that guarantee. Then you've got various things like the rider licenses, haven't you, and the staff licenses, all various other bits. So to be UCI registered, actually, it means you definitely need to be raising more money. So the cost in itself of being UCI registered to go abroad and to also race in some of these big races like the Tour of Britain is definitely a prize that many want, because what they want is the race program ultimately. So, I definitely think we do need UCI Conti teams. Whether or not the sport economically can support so many in the economic environment, I guess that's perhaps questionable. And maybe there is a slimmer structure in the future, but I guess time will tell.
So is Eric on the right lines, do you think, with this elite development team status to try and fill the gap? And just to sort of summarise, his idea is that they will have more space on the British Cycling website, on the British Cycling social media channels. They might have a logo on the jersey like the UCI Europe Tour. And that when they're trying to get race entries to bigger races abroad and perhaps even in this country, and critically when they're trying to attract sponsors, they've got, you know, this badge of recognition that says, hey, we're an elite development team. We're not a professional team, but we're certainly at the sharp end of the development squads in this country. Just with your sponsors hat on, Phil, would Brother be more inclined to sponsor an elite development team than one that didn't have that status, or is your research a bit deeper than that anyway?
Well, the reality is it depends who you are and what you want from the sponsorship, Tim. And actually, I think the what I've learned is actually, I guess, knocking around the sport for hardly any time really relative to Larry, but perhaps for about 8 or 9 years where I've just learned a bit more about the sport, I guess. What I've realised is there's lots of layers within it that you need to sort of peel back. So as you only get that from having a participation in the sport over a period of time, for example. You get to understand at a deeper level who are the influencers, who are the people that are critical, who are the people behind the scenes that aren't in front of the camera. And then you can understand the fabric of a sport a little bit better. And if you, as a sponsor, if your intent is you want to sort of be accepted by a sport as a sort of as part of that fabric, then actually you need to work at all levels within it. You can't just write checks to the best teams and expect to earn your permission to play. The sport itself would want to judge you by the entire amount of actions that you take, and whether it be fans, teams, organisers, volunteers, begin to recognise your brand. So for me, I think it just depends on what you want from your sponsorship. It could well be that if you're a local engineering company and you want to back a team, then actually that it's more about what you're putting into the community of what that team's doing and what local riders are getting, etc. So that could be a big tick in the box. But I think as the elite teams, if their ambition is to become continental in their future, then it's probably quite an important thing that they've got some sort of demarcation that says we are a little bit different and we are the stepping stone that gets you there. So it's the sort of creation of a stepping stone within a team structure, or indeed a rider's potential pathway that they might see ahead of them, that I start here, I go there, then I go there, and then I go there. So that's sort of perhaps maybe behind some of the thinking, which is good. And, if I think about some of the things we do within the day job at my place, then things like tiering structures, differentiation and between different partners, that kind of stuff, is always meaningful to somebody. So I think if it means that an elite team feels that the deck that they might give to a potential sponsor is strengthened, and they feel that they can use that to actually also strengthen their case, then that can't be a bad thing.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting, to see how this plays out. Look, at least two of the teams in our, all three of them, let's face it, Simon does a wonderful job at Onform. Matt pretty much, it would seem, leads the pack in terms of presenting Crimson performance. And as we heard in the earlier episode, and as we'll discuss a bit later, he's reaping the rewards of that. Ian at Brother UK Team LDN, I think these are teams you would hope would easily qualify for that standard. In the articles, I quite often use this phrase, an amateur team with professional standards, and that applies to all three of them. And I guess that's what Eric is hoping to recognise here. Just before we leave this topic, Larry, you sort of raised the $64,000 question. What are we running this series for? And Eric says, and I tend to agree with him, to develop riders to a stage where they can attain professional careers. Clearly, that isn't going to help all of them. As you say, Giles Pidcock's estimation is that, only 20 perhaps have the talent to forge professional careers. But shouldn't that be the aspiration? I guess it comes down to that dividing line, doesn't it? Are we looking for performance, or are we looking for participation? Which side of the line do you fall?
Going back to the interview I did with Giles, he mentioned that, the end result for a lot of riders with talent, such as his two boys, is to race in Europe. And the pathway there is very different now to what it used to be, and also very different now in terms of comparing that to the participation in a National Road Series, which is something different altogether. Riding in the National Road Series isn't going to get you into the World Tour. They don't look at the result. The managers and teams don't look at the results from races here. So it becomes a figurehead for the sport domestically. So it needs to be run professional. It needs to look professional, and it needs to be ridden professionally. but it is its own entity. It is its own pinnacle.
Yeah, it's a critical point. Phil, you were going to come in on that.
Yeah, well, I thought that when we heard Harry speak, that point was sort of hammered right home, wasn't it? You know, Harry's been on the inside of a World Tour team, and you know, he sort of very bluntly said, you know, bottom line is unless it's a UCI race, the teams don't really look at it, the managers don't look at it, your results don't really count so much. So your palmarès has got to really be, you know, demonstrable that you've been racing in UCI races, and perhaps it was that stage win that Harry secured in the Tour de Yorkshire that actually put him on the stage, for example, which then sort of, I guess, gave the springboard to where he is now. But I think the national sport definitely needs something to for people to go through. But ultimately, the real bridge to the World Tour for me is really about how you can be spotted on a World Tour stage. Because unlike maybe football, let's say, believe it or not, at Brother UK, we have somebody that works in our logistics department is a regional scout for a Premier League football club.
Oh, wow. Leading a double life.
Living a double life, yeah. So at his evenings and weekends, he is going all over the Northwest, looking at players, looking at young players particularly who might be able to, you know, come into academy and looking to spot them early doors. Now, such a thing doesn't exist in cycling, doesn't it? So we haven't got, as far as I'm aware, World Tour teams who are sending scouts out to, you know, National Road Series races to look at future talent. So if that is the case, then you've got to force yourself onto their stage and force yourself onto that spotlight. So, you know, it's good that at least the elite program is going to mean that people can develop their skills, but it must be about the stepping stone to then get onto this sort of UCI level of racing. And I thought the other sort of very interesting thing that I think has emerged in the 2020 season at World Tour level is how many new, young, really young riders, I mean, in their early 20s, have emerged.
Yeah, it's felt like a changing of the guard.
Like a changing of the guard. Suddenly, you've got riders in, you know, their early 20s who you would normally expect, the convention of the World Tour would be that you'd need to do many years doing this, many years doing that, and years serving your craft in various, you know, perhaps as a domestique in a Pro Conti team or something like that before you make that step. Whereas there's names, I think, that we've seen appear this year that many people have never heard of before in their early 20s. So I think it for me, that means that might change the way that even World Tour teams look at how they get their young riders, where they look and where they get them from. And for me, then, the importance of certainly domestic riders having exposure in at UCI level becomes really important.
I think...
Yeah, go on, lads.
Just to pick you up on what Phil was saying there about Premier League football, as the Italian league, the German league, Spanish league, are part of a world hierarchy in that sport. So that's why you have scouts which can take people from all over the world from here. Whereas the British sport, the NRS, is more a career in its own right for those riders who want to stay here. And those riders who are capable of riding in Europe at World Tour level, like Harry, like Matt Holmes, like Theo Gegenhardt, etc., they have the talent and they need to take a different pathway. Now, what Giles Pidcock was saying to me and what you just pointed out, Phil, is that the whole scene, the whole thing is changing, and riders are being discovered at a younger age, which is why Giles Pidcock has this junior team and he's taking him in to UCI races to try and get him into continental development teams at a young age so that they can go World Tour. The scene is changing very much.
Isn't all of this drastically underselling the National Road Series? I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate here, but I can't help but feel, you know, we've had a whole generation now of talent from those first academy entrants that recently featured, Laz, on your social media channels, you know, looking at a very young Mark Cavendish, barely recognisable, very young Geraint Thomas. I mean, European teams, the heavyweights of the World Tour, they must know by now that this country does not lack talent. We've also got fantastic races in the shape of the Lincoln Grand Prix, in the shape of the Cycle Classic, in the shape of the Tour of the Reservoir. I mean, why isn't this scene more highly regarded than it is? Matt Holmes won a stage, won the Queen stage of the Tour Down Under. Connor Swift was Nairo Quintana's right-hand man on all the flat stages at the Tour de France. Hugh Carsey was a genuine contender until the penultimate stage for overall victory in the Vuelta a España. You know, this guy began his career really in earnest with John Herity at Condor. It can't just be, surely, that these races don't have a UCI sticker on them.
The scene here is just so different. Hugh Carthy rode here. He never really made a big name for himself domestically. But in World Tour level, a podium and a Grand Tour, that's just awesome. It's just a different world.
But is it? I mean, look at Matt Holmes. He was in the break at the Giro. He was winning. He won the Queen stage of the Tour Down Under. You know, this time last year, he was riding the Rydell Grand Prix or whatever it might have been. You know, clearly this scene is capable of developing talent suitable for the World Tour.
Well, the talent...
Go on.
The talent is there. You take Matt Holmes. Matt Holmes didn't really get discovered until he was fourth or fifth or whatever it was in the Tokyo Olympic test race. That was what helped him into where he is now. And yet before that, Matt had ridden in Tour of Yorkshire and Tour of Britain and performed well, but that wasn't still not enough. And that's a big races. Still wasn't enough to get him a World Tour contract.
Is the question then, you know, do we, you know, Sophie, for example, in the podcast and Bex Durrell, they say, well, actually, you know, racing at the World Tour level is so much more tactical. You know, basic skills like bunch positioning, very, very different. Then you add radios and all that kind of stuff. And they argue that the National Road Series isn't really an appropriate training ground for a career as a professional. The flip side of that is Matt Holmes, Connor Swift, you know, riders that have learned their trade year after year, in the case of Matt particularly, in domestic races and have just made a very smooth transition and instant impact in the World Tour. So, you know, is this a case of advocacy? Phil, we talked about this in the podcast. You know, if the National Road Series, as Eric says, isn't on pro cycling stats because they don't, a lot of these races don't have a UCI badge, and British Cycling puts an awful lot of money and investment into getting a very small, hand-picked group of riders into the World Tour from its academy, shouldn't it be investing in getting Charlie Vergelius, for example, from EF Pro Cycling and saying, look, Charlie, all expenses paid, come and join us in the car at the Lincoln Grand Prix and just come and have a look for yourself. Charlie, of course, would know the Lincoln Grand Prix is a poor example. But, you know, getting a DS, getting a senior manager from one of the World Tour teams, giving them, you know, an enjoyable experience at one of our bigger races and saying, look, these races aren't on pro cycling stats, but have a look for yourself and see the level of talent that exists. Wouldn't that be a sensible step forward?
I think logically you would say yes, but then the rubber hits the road, doesn't it, in the reality of how the world works. And if you think right now, supply and demand, there are a huge number of riders who are hugely capable, who are knocking on the door of the World Tour today, and there's probably an oversupply of riders relevant to the number of seats available on teams. So, you know, if you're the man leading a team, then you probably don't need to look very far for that talent, because the very best of the best has already risen to the top and is already at your doorstep begging you to come in. So actually you probably don't perceive that you need to spend much time travelling all over Europe or the UK trying to find more hidden talent, if you like. There is an oversupply, I think, of riders already. But saying that, do I believe there's a job for advocacy in any sport? Then my answer to that is yes. You know, naturally, somebody needs to be, you know, speaking up for how good the scene is in the UK and making a case for teams to come here and perhaps, you know, come to some of our races and experience what racing in the UK is like as part of perhaps a development process for lower level teams from abroad. But I think fundamentally, much of this is only going to be really resolved if one or two other races can get UCI status in the UK. So if you can get that happening, then some of these teams will have more incentive to come over here. And then as a result of that, of course, some of the elite teams will end up in those same races and exposed to those influential people within teams that might all of a sudden say, you know, who is that lad in the breakaway? We've never heard of him, but, you know, he's 3 miles up the road and our team's chasing him down. We want to know who he is. So for me, it would be, if I was trying to solve this from a business perspective, I would be going, how is it do we get one or two more races here in the UK UCI registered, in order that then we can begin to sort of start to turn the flywheel about around the talent and the riders, and then more visibility for the domestic scene.
In terms of UCI races, there are UCI races and then there are UCI races. There's the 1.2s, which is what the Cycler Classic is, and that has a big foreign number of teams that want to get into it and love the race as we do. However, does the manager of Lotto Soudal or Ineos or any other of the World Tour teams take notice of the Cycler Classic? Probably not. So it needs to be a high level. It needs to be a Ride London type race.
Shouldn't it be the responsibility of the Federation to make sure it is on their radar? Eric's stated goal is that the National Road Series is a platform to develop talent for professional careers. And British Cycling isn't shy about developing riders for professional careers via its Olympic Academy. The first aim, of course, is to win a gold medal. But, you know, we've seen with the house in Italy, all that kind of stuff, that, you know, there was a very definite emphasis on developing road careers for these riders too. Given that the Federation doesn't invest to anything like the same degree in the National Road Series, isn't the very least it can do to advocate for the National Road Series, to give all those riders a chance who aren't on this gilded path to the World Tour, but who have talent, who have dedication, who, in the case of Matt Holmes, make a very smooth transition to the World Tour? You know, the same can be said for, you know, on the women's side with Anna Henderson and Leah Dixon, you know, to choose only two from the brother cycling family. I mean, isn't it the Federation's responsibility to make sure that its own National Road Series is on the radar of the biggest teams in the sport, if its goal is to help riders within it to have professional careers?
From my point of view, if the UCI teams had a minimum wage, then the riders who aren't good enough to ride at World Tour level but are riding the National Road Series can have a career here, because they are being paid, so they are professional riders. I just think that the National Road Series, the way the sport is structured on a world level, the National Road Series is its own entity. It's not, people look upon it as a stepping stone to the World Tour. That isn't the way the world works. The way the world works is you need to take riders into Europe, because we don't have the racers here for them to show themselves in order to move on to bigger and better things. But I think the National Road Series in itself, just like the professional series here was back in the 70s and 80s, etc., it's its own entity. It's its own career. You know, you have riders who don't want to be in Europe. They're quite happy sitting at home and racing here as a career.
Okay, I think we've given that that topic a really useful airing, and some very valid points there made on either side. Let's change the topic. I mean, it's an aligned topic, but it's separate, and that's television. And that ties into what we've discussed already via this UCI continental status. I think it's fair to say that most men's UCI teams in this country want that status so they can ride the Tour of Britain, and that gives them 7 or 8 days of guaranteed national television coverage. And that by itself perhaps justifies a sponsorship investment. Eric says in the podcast, you shouldn't be running a UCI continental team solely to qualify for the Tour of Britain and get that exposure. It's a broader education than that, and should certainly include racing abroad. Television, of course, is a vexed issue by itself. Earlier this year, BC announced that it would no longer fund Eurosport coverage of the National Road Series. arguing that, you know, there were better ways to spend the money, frankly, and that they would investigate other methods of gaining publicity for the National Road Series and other methods of televising it, if that's the right word, via streaming and things like that. And we hear from Eric on that topic in the podcast.
It wasn't value for money at all, having it on Eurosport at 11 o'clock at night, 2 weeks after the race had already happened. And anyone that said there was massive value in that, I would seriously question it. But is there value in a live stream? We did do that for the Circuit Series last year. There wasn't a huge following, I wouldn't have said, on that. I think it was okay. But again, for the money it cost to do a live stream, was there actually that return for it? I don't know. I'm not in that area of expertise to know if it was or not. It's certainly not something which has been put to bed and just forgotten about. It's still ongoing, looking at different ways to do it, both organisers in individually themselves and us as a governing body. It's one of those that's really difficult when you look at the amount of money that was spent on it, and this was pre-COVID. You think, where could that money be better spent? There's so many other things you could do with that amount of money which would be better than it just being on Eurosport 2 weeks after the events happened. To me, this coming from the bike rider point of view, I never bothered watching it on Eurosport. I know I was at most of the races doing it, but I would never tell anyone to watch it either, because the result would already be published, the live tweets already happened, everyone knew the result. It wasn't that valuable, I don't think. I'm sure everyone's got their own opinion on it, but I think something needed to change and look at different ways of doing things, definitely.
Interesting, isn't it, to talk about just how valid television is. On the one hand, you've got British Cycling saying, well, actually, you know, showing the race 2 weeks after the event, the three men and a dog at 11 o'clock at night on Eurosport, frankly, isn't worth the investment. And then you've got Sophie Wright, who's in the Women's World Tour, and, you know, the women's sport is fast developing, and what all of those teams are absolutely crying out for is television coverage. To them, it matters intensely. And we hear from Sophie about that in the podcast, don't we? Let's hear from Sophie now.
Sponsors want to see themselves on TV. They want to be getting their name out there. And so many races aren't televised. So many women's races aren't televised. When a sponsor sees themselves on TV, they can see the worth. They can see that their money and support is actually worth it. Whereas when they can't see themselves on TV, and when the sponsor's logo isn't being shown, they're quite quick to pull out. You don't get much sense of security, really.
We're hearing very different, you know, views, aren't we? On the one hand, BC saying, well, you know, television coverage isn't the be-all and end-all, and actually it's a very expensive way of gaining publicity. And then you've got Sophie, you know, in the Women's World Tour, and the women's sport are absolutely crying out for television coverage. So how do we read that? Laz, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've actually got a question for Phil on this, because at the end of the day, television coverage is going to go to two different demographics. One is the cycling fan, and two is the public at large. And which of those demographics is more important to Brother UK and sponsors of that ilk?
Yeah, well, basically, when we're doing television, what we're looking at there is just what we describe as broad consideration, basically, Larry. So people that are probably not actively looking for a product today, but at some point in their future, they may come to make a purchase. And then what we do as people is we tend to shortlist in our head. So we've already made a mental shortlist of what we call our top three box, the top three brands we might consider for a potential purchase. And then from the shortlisting stage, we then go on to the final purchase, taking into account other things like features or price or availability, things like that. So at the very start of that process, what you're looking to do is have a familiarity with people, where people are familiar with your brand, so that at least you make the mental shortlisting kind of part of the user journey. So that isn't necessarily always doing a job to try and accrue cycling fans. It's trying to sort of reach a broad audience, effectively, who might see our logo and then, you know, a few days later might end up in PC World or Argos and, you know, see a product on the shelf or a catalogue and go, oh, yes, and make the mental association of those two things. If you're looking to go specifically to the cycling market, then we're a lot more sophisticated in that execution. So then you'll see things like the neutral service, you know, sponsorship of specific teams. So wherever you go in domestic racing, you will generally see two out of three assets from Brother at any race. You'll either see a team a neutral service car or a board or hoarding, you know, along, on the side of the road or behind an award, behind the podium. So, but by doing that, we've got sort of a strategy that allows us to not only be considered to be, you know, in the fabric, as I mentioned earlier, but also broadly when the Tour of Britain is being shown, somebody can see our logo behind the podium and associate Brother with the race without actually having necessarily a team participating, if you see what I mean. But I think the issue that nowadays, of course, is media consumption has totally changed, hasn't it? And, you know, television isn't always the answer here. I think we've really got to, you know, answer that question. And I get it in terms of what BC are saying, is that it's frankly not worth the money in terms of the eyeballs that are coming on it relative to what it's costing us. And I go equals okay. If I was responsible for that money, I would probably make a similar decision. So the second part to that question is, well, okay, well, if we're not spending it there, where will we spend it? So what I haven't seen or heard yet is actually, well, the chunk of money that we were investing there is now going to be invested over here instead. And I think this is probably why the teams were sort of initially quite shocked by that announcement, because actually in their sponsorship proposals, you know, this formed an important part of it, is to say that there's this TV coverage. And even regardless of what the reach was, no one was really asking. They were just saying, we can get you on TV. And that was enough for somebody to sort of go, well, all right, then that's great. And I'll give you a little bit of money. But as the stakes increase, and once you start looking at, you know, huge sums of money, then you're looking at very, very granular detail, aren't you? So we've done broadcast campaigns in our past where we've been spending millions, and therefore, you know, we execute through media planners, and we get all sorts of granular information about our audience and where we're going to reach them and all this kind of good stuff. But I think in where we are now, the environment is really simple. It's actually, how can you as a team just help me reach an audience like this? And then it's not necessarily down to just telly. It's down to all the other things that a team might be able to do for you to help you achieve your stated ambition.
So it's a mix of TV and social media.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we really, for us, the TV side really is probably just the women's tour, the Tour of Britain and the Tour series in our portfolio. That for us is just, we look at that and go, look, from just a broad eyeballs per million, you know, so cost per million, that's a very inexpensive way for us to buy broad eyeballs as compared to, let's just say, if we bought billboards at the side of the road near to our office. Everything has a cost, or we bought, you know, sideboards at a rugby match. We can look at all of those costs and say, well, actually, in the cycling market, the demographic is very close to that we're trying to seek anyhow. And then the cost per million for eyeballs is actually very effective. So it kind of works. If that didn't work, then we probably wouldn't do it.
Larry, how have you seen the sports coverage change? You're celebrating 21 years of covering the sport this year and 10 years of Velo UK. I mean, I guess social media would have been a huge change in how you go about your job. What others have you seen?
When I was at British Cycling, social media started to come in, and I'd already had my first Twitter account, and I'd already created another Twitter account for BC, which was at that time not being used. But over the last 10 years, social media has expanded and become a much more valuable part of the whole package. In terms of TV, we had Eurosport for sure, but it wasn't live, and it also wasn't even on the same day. So by the time people got to see the race, it was on late at night, or it was a week later, or it was 2 weeks later. So I think Eurosport coverage didn't have a great deal of value compared to what it could have if it's better targeted and better produced. I don't think the live coverage is as important as a highlights package after the event on the day, hopefully, or at least at the next day.
We've covered a great deal of ground there on the one hand. And on the other, we've barely scratched the surface. So thank you very much indeed, Larry. Thank you very much indeed, Phil. We're at the end of the year, at the end of a tumultuous year, it's fair to say. But I think we can look forward, hopefully, with some optimism and positivity into 2021, all of which, of course, is COVID permitting. Phil, Larry, thank you very much again. Thank you very much indeed for listening. And please check out episode 6, parts 1 and 2, where you'll hear a detailed investigation of the British domestic road scene with some really qualified expert witnesses. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.